This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. Following was home crafted and recorded on May 12th. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky. On May 2nd, Politico published a draft of an upcoming Supreme Court opinion in the matter of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. However, it's really about the 1973 decision Roe versus Wade, and it doesn't bode well for advocates of reproductive health care for women. While leaks are extremely rare, they are not unprecedented. Wired magazine cites the infamous Dred Scott case of 1857 that upheld slavery, noting that newspapers began to report the outcome 3 months ahead of the final decision. While it's less rare, it's still far from common for the court to reverse previous decisions. University of Minnesota law professor David Schultz calculates that it has happened in less than 1% of all Supreme Court decisions in its 200-plus year history. Needless to say, the leak 2 weeks ago set off a firestorm in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is no stranger to this program. Stephen Vladek holds the Charles Allen Wright Chair in Federal Courts at the UT Law School. He's a nationally recognized expert on the federal courts, constitutional law, national security law, and military justice. Professor Vladek has argued over a dozen cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, the Texas Supreme Court, and various lower federal civilian and military courts. He is CNN's lead Supreme Court analyst and can often be heard on NPR and occasionally read in the New York Times. We also have Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project, and Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of the show, is here as well. Many thanks for joining us this evening, Steve. Great to have you on Co-op once again.
Thanks, Bob. Great to be with you.
If people haven't heard anything about the Supreme Court in the last 2 weeks, they must be living under a rock. The coverage of the infamous leak has finally started to subside a little bit. I do want to hear your own perspectives on this, especially the precedence as a leak itself and probably more important, the impending ruling. Let's start off with that, if you don't mind.
Bob, I think it's worth starting by pointing out that it's not even one leak. It's actually, by this point, you know, depending on how you count, either four or five, where for whatever reason, people close to different of the justices have felt comfortable talking to the press, and in one case, you know, sharing a draft of the original majority opinion Justice Alito circulated in February about how the Supreme Court's going to resolve Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. This is, you know, the big sort of frontal assault on Roe Casey and the constitutional right to a pre-viability abortion. And Bob, I guess I'm struck by two very different but maybe overlapping features of the story. The first is just how unprecedented it is to have this kind of a leak, indeed this kind of a series of leaks, out of the court. I mean, there have been notorious prior episodes where, you know, shortly before a decision came out, There was some leaking about the result. Roe versus Wade is actually an example of that. Time magazine ran the result in Roe a week before it actually came out. But we've never seen it quite like this, where it was, you know, the leak of a draft opinion while the justices are still deliberating, where I think everyone assumes, even if we disagree about where the leaks are coming from, that the purpose of the leaks is to intimidate, you know, the justices perceived to be in the middle into either, you know, going one way or the other. Whichever side you're coming from and whichever side you think the intimidation is trying to go to, I think everyone agrees that the goal here is actually, you know, trying to either lock in the votes of someone like a Justice Brett Kavanaugh or convince him to not join Alito and overrule Roe and Casey. And, you know, Bob, that's frankly a stunning development in the history of the Supreme Court as an institution, that we would see this kind of, you know, public intimidation campaign, this kind of public pressure, even if we're not sure whether it's coming from the right or the left.
As you point out, we've actually seen the actual draft of the decision, again, not finalized, and appreciate your comments about the motivation for all this. That notwithstanding, what do you make of Alito's arguments in there?
I think they're staggering. You know, I think the opinion is remarkably hostile to principles that we've taken for granted for quite some time, including, among other things, the idea of stare decisis and the idea that all things being equal, you know, the court should follow its precedents. But also, Bob, more fundamentally, you know, the notion that the court has the authority and in some cases the responsibility to identify at least some unenumerated rights, that is to say, rights that are not, you know, contemplated expressly in the text of the Constitution. It's remarkable to me how hostile Justice Alito's majority opinion is to that idea. And in various places where he talks about how such rights to exist at all must be, in his words, deeply rooted in our country's traditions, that is, I fear, a roadmap toward revisiting not just Roe and Casey and the right to pre-viability abortion, but plenty of other rights that we have come to take for granted in this country. And, you know, one of the things that's been most remarkable to me about everything that's happened since the leaks is that the principal defense that we've heard from conservatives is that, no, this is just about abortion. And how do we know? Because the opinion says it's only about abortion. You know, the reality is that it's very easy to see how, armed with an opinion like this, state legislatures that wanted to push the envelope could on matters from contraception, education, to end-of-life healthcare decisions. And so, you know, the real disconnect I'm seeing, Bob, is between conservatives who say this won't be extended to other contexts and examples that we have both here in Texas and around the country of conservative state legislators, if not entire conservative state legislatures, really willing to revisit those precedents and to pass laws that are going to call those precedents into question.
Jim, as one who's argued civil rights cases for decades, what was your take on all this?
To me, it was stunning, absolutely, and stunning in the tone Alito adopted and the arrogance and the disregard, I think, for where we've come in constitutional law and stare decisis, particularly after, you know, pledging during the confirmation hearings that, I mean, all of these folks, that they were going to adhere to stare decisis. But I share the pessimism of Steve, you know, in that we're going to see, whether or not they're ultimately successful, but we're going to see an onslaught of different ways, I think, to undo whatever has come into existence through the idea of a right of privacy or equal protection, the expansion of equal protection. And, you know, my first thought was, you know, elections have consequences, you know, and we are where we are because a lot of people didn't turn out for Hillary Clinton. And we're paying the price for that. And it's going to be a price that I'm afraid is going to take generations to undo. I'm also interested in Steve's comments on the shadow docket, because here's another place that we're just seeing upheaval by the court, not only in our practice, but in the substantive results of those shadow docket cases.
Maybe, Steve, you could lead off just to kind of define what the shadow docket means and how it got there. You know, if I understand it right, it was sort of a convenience to deal with insignificant cases or procedures requiring quick attention. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little more than that, but I mean, and it ties together with the abortion conversation. So, you know, the term shadow docket was actually coined in 2015 by a University of Chicago professor named Will Bode to describe a practice that the Supreme Court has had forever. I mean, every appeals court, whether it's a state court or a federal court, has to have some mechanism for figuring out what to do with everything other than its big, fancy merits cases. And so the Supreme Court, you know, as you guys both know, issues thousands of orders every year, the overwhelming majority of which are anodyne and are just not the kinds of things anyone cares about. But there is a very small subset of those orders, most of which involve applications for emergency relief. That is to say, context where the full case has not yet reached the Supreme Court, but the parties are asking the Supreme Court to step in to adjust the status quo while the case works its way to the Supreme Court. And it's really in that space that we've seen a radical shift in how often the Supreme Court uses the shadow docket and in what it uses it for, really in the last 5 years. And so, as you guys know, I'm writing a book about this. It'll be out probably around this time next year. But the basic sort of gist is that over and over again, we are seeing the Supreme Court, you know, use orders, unsigned, unexplained, often one sentence pieces of paper in ways that actually have enormous substantive effects on the ground. So, you know, one example is SB 8, the Texas abortion ban. You know, that was allowed to go into effect last September because the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, refused to block it. And that was, you know, with one paragraph of, frankly, I think, pretty conclusory and not satisfying explanation. And even that was more than the court usually provides. This February, we had the Supreme Court put back into effect congressional district maps in Alabama that, you know, two different district courts had held to violate the Voting Rights Act. And the court issued what's called a stay of those district court decisions with no analysis, with no majority opinion, with no rationale at all. We saw the same thing in April when the court put back into effect a controversial Trump administration rule about the Clean Water Act, the net effect of which is to make it a lot easier for power plants to pollute navigable waterways. Bob and Jim, as you guys know, but as I think maybe a lot of folks listening don't, what is so fascinating about these orders is not just how many more of them there are, but it's that increasingly the Chief Justice is joining the liberals in dissenting from them. You know, we saw that in the SB 8 case in September. We saw that in the Alabama redistricting case in February. We saw that in the Clean Water Act case in April, where, you know, the Chief Justice, even though he might be sympathetic to the results the court is reaching in these cases, is nevertheless dissenting because he thinks that the other five conservatives are basically taking procedural shortcuts and defying, you know, what have long been well understood limits on the court's power to issue this kind of so-called emergency relief just because they have the votes and they want to change the law faster. And, you know, I think it's important, even as we come to the end of this Supreme Court term and we get a whole bunch of very high profile merits decisions in the abortion case, in the guns case, on, you know, other hot ticket items, that we don't lose sight of how much work the court is doing behind the scenes through these orders, oftentimes in ways that actually have just as significant effects as the big merits rulings that, you know, get so much more public attention.
Well, and that's the way it's presented in the media too. I mean, you know, when I heard about the SB 8 decision, for example, it just sounded like any other Supreme Court decision. And yet it clearly wasn't, you know, there's this short circuit in there that they wind up using. We already know that Roe versus Wade, you know, is the big earthquake that's coming, you know, but in SB 8, there's a whole lot more to it, isn't there? I mean, just the whole vigilante justice that seems to be part and parcel of that law. The problem is that this stuff sets a precedent then.
Bob, I think that's right. And indeed, I mean, historically, one of the real constraints on these emergency orders was that the court insisted, you know, it died on the hill that these orders were not precedential, meaning that, like, you couldn't rely upon them in other cases involving other parties. And yet we are seeing both directly and indirectly these recent orders, these recent uses of the shadow docket having precedential effect. So, you know, explicitly, the Supreme Court has chastised lower courts for not following unsigned, unexplained orders in some of these shadow docket cases. There were a slew of those rulings involving California's COVID restrictions, for example. And then implicitly, we are seeing lower courts, you know, structure their decision making based on the tea leaves they're reading into these unsigned, unexplained Supreme Court rulings. So I mentioned, you know, the Alabama redistricting case from February. Well, 10 days after the court's unsigned, unexplained order, you know, putting Alabama's maps back into place, a district judge in Georgia, a different state, right, with different maps, after concluding that the plaintiffs had carried their burden to show that those maps were unlawful, that they represented vote dilution in violation of the Voting Rights Act, that Georgia was obliged to draw at least one more so-called majority-minority district, which almost certainly would have added another Democratic seat to the Georgia congressional delegation, the district judge says, all these things are true, but I'm not actually going to issue an injunction because of what the Supreme Court did in the Alabama case, because, you know, I don't think I can ignore that when considering whether to actually prevent Georgia from using these unlawful district maps. And so, you know, Bob, to my mind, in some respects, what's happening on the shadow docket is an even greater threat and challenge to the court's legitimacy than even the draft leaked opinion in the abortion case. Because at least there, you know, the court is writing in that case, you know, 90 some odd pages of analysis to try to rationalize its result. On the shadow docket, it's not writing anything. And, you know, I'm really struck by the juxtaposition of two things that happened the first week of April. On Monday, April 4th, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, for now the newest member of the court, gave a speech at the Ronald Reagan Library where she said, you know, listen, we hand down divisive opinions. You guys often perceive those rulings as political. And all I want to ask you to do is read our decisions for yourself. Read the opinion, she said. And then you can decide whether we are, you know, simply politicians in robes or whether we're actually relying on legal principles. You may not agree with those principles, but at least you'll agree that there are principles. And then 2 days later, you know, she's the fifth vote in this Clean Water Act case where there was no opinion to read. And so, you know, I really do think that this has become a much bigger problem than a lot of the court's defenders and indeed even some of the justices themselves have appreciated, because it is becoming increasingly apparent to the public, whether because of the SB 8 case or because of the sort of increasing body of cases like this, how the justices are using the shadow docket to change the law without changing the law, and how much more of a departure from the principles that have historically guided the Supreme Court's decision making these rulings represent.
Steve, I'd be interested in you commenting just a bit on the perceived legitimacy of the court being weakened, if you want to say that. Your thoughts on that and what it bodes for the future.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a good question. It's a hard one to answer in the moment. I mean, you know, Bush versus Gore, the December 2000 decision that basically, you know, handed the presidency to George W. Bush had immense short-term effect on how the court was perceived publicly, but actually very little long-term effect. And so I don't know that we can say confidently that all of the polls that are showing sharp, dramatic decline in public support for and confidence in the Supreme Court, I don't know we can say confidently that those are going to persist, you know, that those aren't going to rebound. But, you know, Jim, what strikes me as being different about the current moment versus Bush versus Gore is that, you know, Bush versus Gore, for all of its warts, was a one-off, right? It was a one-time decision. It wasn't part of a broader body of decisions. It wasn't immediately at the end of a contentious series of political moves through which one side had entrenched a majority on the Supreme Court. Whereas here, you know, we have these acts in succession, right? We have, you know, the circumstances of Justice Scalia's death and Judge Garland's non-confirmation. We have, you know, the circumstances of Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation upon Justice Kennedy's retirement. We have the circumstances of Justice Barrett's confirmation. We have all of these sort of increasingly visible and controversial decisions, whether on the merits docket or the shadow docket. And I just, you know, Jim, I really worry that these are a persistent and sustained series of body blows to the court's legitimacy, the likes of which we have not seen in a long time. And there are folks on the left, you know, including, I suspect, some folks who are even listening to us today, you know, who would see that as a feature, not a bug, that an illegitimate court is something to be celebrated, not worried over. And I guess I disagree. I mean, I just, you know, I think that our constitutional system depends upon an anti-democratic, or at least a counter-democratic, a counter-majoritarian court that's in a position to protect minority rights, you know, from the tyranny of the majority, even if at the moment that's not what the court is doing. And so I guess it just seems to me that this is a much larger and more sustained threat to the court's legitimacy than anything we've seen probably in our lifetimes. And that, you know, a court that isn't legitimate, a court that is not perceived as doing, you know, what it's supposed to be doing by a large percentage of the American people, guys, is a court that I'd be very worried about when we needed it most. For example, if we have in the 2024 presidential election, you know, an outcome determinative dispute that ends up in the Supreme Court. And as much as I sort of might not like what the court does in individual cases these days, I prefer having a court that was legitimate to one that was not.
Well, even Justice Roberts, as you point out, has sided with some of the dissenting opinions on these things. It's almost as if we've got the other five conservatives don't even bother listening to them.
Yeah, I mean, Bob, I really do think that's part of the story here, that much more so this term than last term, we've seen a pretty sharp split between Chief Justice Roberts and the rest of the conservatives. Just a little bit of data. I mean, as we are recording this, you know, in the middle of May, there have been a total of 9 dissents since Justice Barrett joined the court in late October of 2020, where the court split 5-4 and Chief Justice Roberts was one of the dissenters. Of those 9, 8 of those were cases in which the dissent was 5-4 with the liberals, right, where Roberts joined the liberals in dissenting. And of those 8, 7 were on the shadow docket. So we have seen this increasing split between Roberts and the other conservatives, especially in the shadow docket context, where, you know, his institutional sensibilities, I think, depart most sharply from his substantive preferences. And, you know, I think that's likely to only expand and proliferate. I mean, I mentioned this April ruling about the Clean Water Act. You know, the Clean Water Act is technical. I don't think folks are going to necessarily want to spend a lot of time on the specifics of that case. But one of the real headlines of that ruling is that it wasn't just that Chief Justice Roberts joined the liberals in dissenting. It was that for the first time, he specifically joined a dissenting opinion from the liberals that criticized the other conservatives' use of the shadow docket. In the prior examples we've been talking about, he wrote his own dissents and went his own way. You know, now he's on board with the procedural criticism that the other conservatives are abusing these procedural orders to reach, you know, premature and unjustified substantive results. And guys, I mean, just to me, that ought to be a canary in the coal mine, you know, even for those who are otherwise not as bothered by the bottom lines the court is reaching in these cases, you know, as I am and as I suspect you are.
And surely there are legal scholars all throughout the country who must be alarmed by all this. Do you have any sense about a remedy for this? What can be done?
Well, you know, first my book. No, that's it's too soon. It's too soon even for pre-orders. But I think the first and most important thing, and this is where I'm really glad that we're talking about it today, is I really just think increased public awareness and attention is a pretty important starting point. I mean, I think this is an area that a lot of folks just didn't even know existed in the Supreme Court's workload until recently. And, you know, the more that folks are paying attention to this stuff, I think the more pressure the court will feel to, you know, moderate its behavior. We've already seen some examples of that. I mean, so, you know, this term that started last October, you know, we've seen at least Justices Barrett and Kavanaugh talking about how maybe they're not going to grant emergency relief just because, you know, they think that the plaintiffs have a good case. We've seen the court, you know, agree to hold oral argument on the applications for emergency relief in both the OSHA vaccinator test rule cases and the CMS health worker mandate cases, those two big Biden administration vaccine mandate cases. Mm-hmm. The court held oral argument on those applications. That may seem like a little sort of small thing, but guys, it was the first time the court had agreed to hear argument on an application for emergency relief as opposed to in a merits case since the early 1970s. We've seen the court change its rules to allow for more formalized briefing respecting emergency applications. And so I guess, you know, it seems like at least some of this public attention and pressure is in fact inducing the court to be a little more sensitive to how it's handling the shadow docket and what it's doing on the shadow docket. So that's, you know, one place to start. You know, the other thing to say is this is actually an area where historically, I think there was a whole lot more room for an understanding of Congress as a relevant actor in the conversation. I mean, you know, for the first 200 years that the Supreme Court existed, Congress was regularly engaged in a dialogue with the court about its docket, about its workload, about what kinds of cases it should and shouldn't be hearing. And, you know, that has really fallen by the wayside over the last really 34 years, since 1988. And so yes. If the court's not going to sufficiently adjust its own behavior, I think the next step is to try to, you know, make the case in Congress on nonpartisan terms that what the court is doing in this context is unhealthy. And that, you know, there are reforms to the court's docket, both the merits docket and the shadow docket, that Congress has the power to pursue and that Congress ought to pursue.
So where do you see right now the power center of the court, and will that power center ever yield to Roberts?
Yeah, I mean, Jim, I think this showed up first on the shadow docket, but I think it's now clearly also part of the merits docket. You know, I think one of the things that has become abundantly clear over the course of the current Supreme Court term is that this is no longer the Roberts Court, and indeed that it hasn't been since the day, you know, Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed to replace Justice Ginsburg, and that there really aren't contexts, at least not big contexts, in which Roberts is going to be the median vote anymore. Rather, I think that now falls to the two most recent, you know, appointees. That falls to, you know, Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh. And I think we saw the first couple of sort of signs of that, you know, last October in a case about the vaccine mandate for Maine healthcare workers, where even though Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch wanted the court to block that mandate, Barrett writes a one-paragraph concurrence in the court's refusal to do so that Kavanaugh joins, saying, hey guys, you know, just because we're sympathetic to your claims on the merits doesn't mean that we're going to, you know, grant emergency relief in every single case. And Jim, I thought that was a really important public declaration of independence by Barrett and Kavanaugh from the Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch troika. And I think it was a reaffirmation of what a lot of court watchers suspected, which is that it's really as those two go that the court is going to go in the near term. And that, you know, for the really, really divisive cases, it's going to take at least one of them joining the Chief Justice and the liberals, you know, for there to be a real sort of shift in favor of the liberals on a hot button topic.
We're speaking with Professor Stephen Vladeck from the UT Law School. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on May 12th. Our guest is Professor Stephen Vladeck, who holds the Charles Allen Wright Chair in Federal Courts at the UT Law School. Let's pick up where we left off.
What's your bet on who that is?
You know, Jim, I think it varies by context. I mean, I think there are some pretty significant differences in how Justice Barrett and Justice Kavanaugh approach these cases. You know, I think there are contexts in which I think it's more likely to be Justice Barrett if it's about, I don't know, separation of powers or criminal justice or, you know, areas where Justice Kavanaugh really is much more likely to be very, very conservative. But there might be some institutional context where Kavanaugh is actually the one who's more likely to, you know, subordinate his personal ideological preferences to what he thinks is in the best interest of the institution and go with the chief. You know, just to sort of tie threads together, that's my best bet for what the jockeying and politicking in the abortion case is all about, that it's all about Kavanaugh. And it's all about either concern on the right that Kavanaugh is wobbling about joining an opinion that overrules Roe and Casey, or optimism on the left that that's happening. And so, you know, for better or for worse, I think the abortion case just brings to the forefront a tension that's lurking in a whole bunch of cases, where, you know, the Chief Justice wants to be more moderate, not necessarily in the bottom line, but at least in how the court is going about reaching it. And the question is going to be whether he's able to peel off any of the other conservatives or not.
I think that that's a really good observation, is that they're sort of, just the way you put it, that Conan Bryant and Kavanaugh are in the middle. They're the swing, even though they're to the right. You know, and I've been struck, too, by the arrogance in some of the opinions by Thomas and by Alito. And that bothers me a lot, you know, that they've sort of let their personal views, and the language of Alito, of course, is pretty extreme. But I don't know if there's any way to deal with it other than doing better at the hearings than what we've been doing.
One thing to say is, I mean, I think we should perhaps, you know, get out of the mindset that the courts are going to save us. I mean, I know you know this better than anybody from all of your, you know, litigation experience, but, you know, we live in an era where, for better or for worse, and, you know, through a series of pretty fluky and politically manufactured circumstances, conservatives control the federal judiciary and the Supreme Court, and are likely to, at least for the medium term. And, you know, I think it's pretty clear that the kinds of structural reforms that could adjust that overnight are unlikely to happen so long as the Senate has a filibuster. And so I think the conversation ought to shift a bit. If not the courts, then what? And I think that's where perhaps, you know, more attention on local and state elections is a big deal, right? More attention on doing what you can to try to turn states like Texas blue or at least purple, so that, you know, the kinds of laws that are leading to these troubling Supreme Court decisions don't get enacted in the first place. You know, I think that's probably where this conversation has to go.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that, we've lived for a long time in this idea that we get our rights from the Supreme Court, not understand that we're actually the tail that's going to wag that dog.
Yep.
Looking ahead at what's coming down the pipe here in June, the traditional climax of the court session, maybe we could go through just a few of the categories of cases that are before the court. For example, I've been reading quite a bit about prayer in public schools. We've talked about separation of church and state before. Is this one case of the, I think it's a coach. Is that significant or is that mostly media hype?
Is it possible the answer is both? So, I mean, the case is called Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, and it's a question about whether, you know, a public school can prevent a coach from engaging in basically organized prayer at the 50-yard line at the end of, you know, his high school football games. Bob, there's a lot to say about this case, including how it was litigated. You know, there have at various points been some pretty significant misrepresentations made about what the coach is doing. But, you know, I think that whatever the court says in this case, and in a case that's flying under the radar but shouldn't, called Cameron versus Macon, one of the places where I don't think we'll see the Chief Justice, you know, depart from the other conservatives is in expanding the free exercise clause and, you know, increasingly narrowing the establishment clause so that, you know, there's ever greater protections for religious exercise in context in which we might previously have thought that the constraint was, you know, that the exercise is actually government endorsement of religion. You know, when a public high school coach is leading an organized Christian prayer at the end of a football game, and when, you know, as any number of folks have said, players on the team feel pressure to participate in that prayer, even if it's not consistent with their own religious beliefs, you know, that certainly seems like the endorsement of religion. And yet, you know, I think this is where the court is heading, to basically recognize claims that certainly look like, you know, their establishments of religion in the guise of protecting individuals' religious expression.
Well, moving on, as one who has argued a border case before the Supreme Court, what's on the docket for border issues or immigration issues this time around?
I mean, there's actually a whole lot of immigration-related cases on the court's docket. You know, perhaps the biggest one of all is Biden versus Texas. This is about the Biden administration's effort to rescind the Trump administration's controversial so-called Remain in Mexico asylum policy, where the challenge is not to the Trump administration policy itself, but rather the Biden administration said, we're now in charge, so we're going to get rid of this policy. And it was sued by Texas, which basically said, you know, you can't get rid of this policy. And a federal district judge here in Texas agreed and subjected the Biden administration to an injunction basically where the district judge has decided what our immigration policy should be. So, you know, that I think is structurally the most important of these cases. It was just argued, you know, right at the end of the last argument session a couple weeks ago. And I think that's probably going to drown out the other immigration cases insofar as how much power and discretion this and future presidents will have to change their minds about their predecessors' immigration policies in a context in which, you know, most policy is set by the president, in which Congress generally doesn't, you know, and isn't able to interfere that often, to intervene that often. So, you know, I think that case, Biden versus Texas, is going to be a really important bellwether, not just for MPP specifically, the Remain in Mexico policy, but for immigration policy across the board. There are some other more specific challenges to immigration policies in the court. There's a case involving an unlawful, or at least an allegedly unlawful, search and seizure by CBP officers of a U.S. citizen's property inside the U.S. on the Washington-Canadian border. But, you know, it's hard to think of those cases in the same vein as the Biden versus Texas case, because that case is just such a fundamental question about, you know, the executive's power over immigration law writ large.
And how about the eternal issue of guns? What's happening this round?
Yeah, I mean, what's funny about all the abortion news is it's totally drowned out, you know, what's probably the most important Second Amendment case that the court has heard since at least 2010. So in this case called Bruin versus, you know, New York State Rifle Association, this is about public carry. And, you know, unlike Texas, there are a number of states that don't generally allow for the public carrying of firearms, or at the very least, that require individuals to have a license in order to carry firearms publicly. And the claim in this case is that New York's licensing requirement is so onerous that it is, you know, in fact, almost prohibiting public carry, and that New York sort of enforces and applies its licensing requirement in ways that defeat the whole purpose. So, you know, there are two different sets of questions in this case. The first is whether the court's going to hold that the Second Amendment protects a right to public carry at all. And then if so, whether that right, you know, requires states to do particular things when it comes to licensing regimes, whether states are allowed to have licensing regimes at all. And if so, what kinds of conditions states are allowed to impose on obtaining a license to carry firearms publicly. So, you know, both of those, Bob, are pretty big deals for not just, you know, the question of public carry in states in which it's not already legal, but for lots of other sort of Second Amendment type cases, because, you know, the Supreme Court's being asked for the first time in 12 years to actually add some clarity to not just what the Second Amendment protects, but to how courts are even supposed to assess whether different kinds of gun regulations and restrictions violate the Second Amendment. So, you know, a really, really big deal case. Any other term, I think, what might have been the biggest case of the term, and it's just sort of, you know, background noise to the abortion dispute. And I should say, I mean, it's probably self-evident, but just to drive the point home, you know, whatever happens in that case is not likely to have a big deal here in Texas or in many other red states, because, you know, most of those states have already allowed, as a matter of state law, you know, fairly broad public carry. A decision in that case is going to have much more of an impact in states with more restrictive gun laws, like in that case, New York.
Fairly broad doesn't begin to describe what it is in Texas right now.
Indeed.
You know, it's really non-existent near as I can tell, but... How about healthcare, especially in the what's hopefully the wake of COVID-19? Are there cases that are just going to disappear because of the demise, hopefully the demise of COVID, or what else is going on there?
Well, you know, there aren't a lot of cases on the court's merits docket that are specifically about any particular sort of vaccine mandates or other health-related COVID issues. There are some pretty significant but technical cases involving Medicare, the government health insurance program predominantly for senior citizens, that actually raise some fairly foundational questions of administrative law that go well beyond, you know, healthcare, and that really go much more to how much power Congress can give to administrative agencies in the first place. And those could also be pretty significant shifts in the court's jurisprudence if, as at least some folks suspect, right, the court uses those cases to say, you know, Congress has less power to delegate to administrative agencies than we thought, right, than it used to. It's hard to sort of concretize for folks why those cases are as important as, say, the abortion or guns cases. But they actually are in some ways related, because the modern structure of the federal government presupposes that Congress has very broad authority to delegate to federal agencies. I mean, it would be impossible, right, to leave every single question of federal regulation to Congress. You know, hey, Congress, what should, you know, the emission standards be for a particular class of vehicles? Hey, Congress, what should the food inspection rules be for a particular class of livestock? Right? Congress has historically said we'll have these specialized executive branch agencies to make those decisions. And, you know, the Medicare cases, although they're, you know, putatively about delegation to HHS to do Medicare, what they're really about is whether, you know, Congress has to be either much more specific when giving this kind of power to administrative agencies, or whether Congress can do it in the first place. So, you know, those are, Bob, to me, you know, in the category of sleeper cases, cases that are really important to the lawyers and that will really affect the public, but that are, you know, maybe not as visible or obvious to the public at first blush.
Well, the other category that really caught my eye were all the suits involving the state of West Virginia and the environment. Care to comment on those or any other EPA or environmental issues?
Yeah, I mean, so the West Virginia versus EPA case is this, it's the denouement of this really long-running dispute going all the way back to the Obama administration about the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan and, you know, the efforts and ability of the EPA to try to regulate emissions, greenhouse gas emissions by, you know, electrical plants and other industrial concerns. And, you know, Bob, I think it's possible those cases will be resolved pretty narrowly on the basis of the specific environmental law questions they raise, but those cases in some respects dovetail with the Medicare cases we were just discussing, insofar as they raise, you know, these sort of more fundamental questions about Congress's power to let agencies do any of this in the first place. There's a doctrine that dates to the 1930s known as the non-delegation doctrine, and it was in vogue, you know, early in the New Deal as a means by which the Supreme Court limited Congress's power to delegate authority to the Roosevelt administration to figure out how to deal with the New Deal. And, you know, the non-delegation doctrine, as Cass Sunstein has famously put it, has had one good year and about 230 bad ones, right, where 1935 was the good year. Well, you know, we may be on the verge of partying like it's 1935 because, you know, both in the environmental cases you mentioned and in the Medicare cases, there have been sustained efforts by folks on the right to get the court to put teeth back into the non-delegation doctrine to limit Congress's power. And what's especially telling, and I wonder if Jim has thoughts on this, what's especially telling about the arguments in these cases is that they are typically presented as sort of a democratic, like small d, like a pro-democracy argument that, you know, it's better for this power to be held by, you know, Congress than by unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats in government agencies. The reality is actually that if it's not going to be exercised by, you know, unelected but accountable bureaucrats in these agencies, it's going to be exercised by the courts, right? That the real transfer of power here is not from the executive branch to the legislative branch, it's from the executive branch to the courts, because now we'll be faced with circumstances where federal agencies are arguing that they have the authority to act based on language in statutes Congress enacted, even if not expressly delegating them that authority, and it'll be up to the courts to decide that question. And so it seems to me that, you know, as between executive branch agencies that are accountable to the democratically elected president and, you know, federal courts that aren't accountable to anybody, it seems to me that the better sort of pro-democracy argument is to go the executive branch route. That's not where we are.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what's lost in that too is expertise. And we end up with all these mixed rulings with judges doing stuff that's off the wall. Yeah, to me, it's really a way of stymieing change that we need, and that the agencies have the capacity to enact and to guide us.
I mean, it's deregulatory more than anything.
Yeah, and chaotic. We're already stuck as a government right now, I mean, pretty much. And limiting the agencies would be even worse. I'm also struck, and I don't know if this is typical, but how political the Trump judges are. I mean, all the way down, particularly at the trial level.
You know, Jim, we have this particular phenomenon in Texas that I think is largely invisible to the public, but that is really striking. So, you know, usually, Jim, as you know, when you file a federal lawsuit, you know, you file it in a particular district court. You might even choose the district court if you can, based on, you know, what kind of law there is in that circuit. So, you know, environmental groups might try to file in California, right? Energy groups might try to file in Texas. But once you pick the district court, usually the case is randomly assigned to any one of the, you know, sometimes two dozen, right, judges who sit in that district. Texas is a little strange, right? We have here in Texas this phenomenon sort of shorthanded as single judge divisions, where, you know, even though Texas has four federal district courts spread out across the whole state, a number of those district courts are subdivided into small divisions, and those divisions have one judge. And so if you file your lawsuit in that division, you are all but guaranteed of drawing that same judge. So for example, I mean, Austin's not one of them, but Waco, right? The Waco division has a single judge. If you file a federal lawsuit in Waco, you are almost guaranteed of drawing the same judge. And we've seen Texas, the state of Texas as a litigant, you know, Jim, really take advantage of this phenomenon in lawsuits challenging Biden administration policy. I mean, by my count, you know, so far in the 16 months of the Biden administration, Texas has sued the Biden administration 26 times. And, you know, 21 or 22 of those lawsuits have been filed in single judge divisions in Texas where they know which judge they're getting. So, you know, they keep filing immigration cases in the Victoria division of the Southern District where they know that they're drawing Trump-appointed Judge Tipton. They keep filing other immigration cases in the Amarillo division of the Northern District. I mean, you know, guys, I'm no geography expert, but Amarillo is about as far from the border as you can get and still be in Texas. And they're doing it because they keep drawing Trump-appointed Judge Matthew Kaczmarek. So, you know, Jim, I think part of the issue here is not just that President Trump's judicial appointees have further polarized the federal bench, but that, you know, these quirky, hitherto, I think, unnoticed procedural rules have allowed savvy institutional litigants to capitalize on that and to almost handpick the most outlier of these district judges to hear these lawsuits, to block these policies, you know, and then to sort of see what happens. You know, we heard a lot of complaining from conservatives during the Trump administration about the rise of so-called nationwide injunctions. Well, they're being used just as often against Biden administration policies, but now it's conservative judges issuing them. And the folks who were so critical of them during the Trump administration all of a sudden have grown quiet. So I think it's not just the problem of outlier judges, Jim. I also think it's the problem of how easy it is for politically minded litigants to direct their litigation to those outlier judges, and how criticisms about the powers of those judges that were in vogue during the Trump administration have disappeared.
Yeah, well, you want to talk about activist judges, right?
Speaking about the state of Texas suing the feds, Jim, is there any update on Ken Paxton's membership in the Texas bar?
Well, thanks to Paxton's tweets, we know that the state bar is going to sue him because, you know, the proceedings are pretty close to the vest in the state bar. But I think it's significant, you know, that they're going after him. They went after his deputy already up in Williamson County. It'll be interesting. I'm sure that Paxton will ever use every procedural device he has, as he has in his criminal cases, to stall and hopefully get it in front of the Texas Supreme Court that would be favorable to him. So we'll see. I mean, it's amazing we got this far so far.
Well, Steve, we're just about out of time. Wondering if you'd have any quick comments on the nomination and confirmation process for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Oh, man. I mean, I think it's just a symptom, guys, of the broader disease that, you know, is continuing to infect our courts in general, the Supreme Court in particular. I mean, the sort of the extent to which the Republican opposition to Judge Jackson was based on ridiculous mischaracterizations of her record or phony and invented issues, you know, attempts to sort of raise complaints that they, you know, didn't have for prior nominees who were even more problematic in those respects. It really does reinforce the view that it's just politics all the way down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's not going to surprise a lot of folks, but the more that that is increasingly how the public views not just the confirmation process, but the court itself, I think in the long term, the worse off for all of us. And what I think has disappointed me the most about the Supreme Court's current term, including and perhaps most directly in the abortion case and the leaks relating to it, is how much the Supreme Court is now, you know, sort of, if not intentionally, at least, you know, willfully reinforcing that perspective and doing very little to disabuse the public at large of that claim. These are, in the end, just politicians in robes. And, you know, in the long term, that may seem like progress for progressives who, you know, worry about what this court is going to do. But I keep believing that in the long term, it's actually a bad thing for all of us.
I don't suppose you've got anything to say about Ginni Thomas.
Well, I think that's consistent with the prior remarks.
Okay. Well, Steve, as always, this has been a real pleasure and an honor to have you join us here. As I pointed out, I haven't said too much on the air about this, but we're winding down the show. May 31st will be our last episode, and you were one of the people I wanted to make sure that we got on one more time here. So we're deeply grateful for all of your insights and for your work. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, thanks. I mean, thanks to you, Bob, and thanks for doing the show. It's an immense public service.
Well, it's been great.
And it's always been fascinating. You are a walking treasure of information, I'll tell you.
Thanks.
Well, it's Thursday, May 12th, and once again, Austin Sanders is with us, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. Happy Thursday, Austin.
Hey, Bob, how are you?
Okay. You know, it sort of flew by a lot of people, but there was actually an election last Saturday, and there was sort of a landslide result. Could you remind us what that was about?
Yeah. There was a statewide and local elections, some state constitutional amendments, both dealing with property taxes. Those passed across the state. Locally in Austin, our local measure was a petition initiative called Prop A, which would basically amend the city charter to prohibit the Austin Police Department from arresting people or issuing citations for possessing small amounts of marijuana. Basically, any misdemeanor offense, possession of marijuana offense under state law, which is up to 4 ounces of marijuana, which is quite a bit. So it kind of broadly decriminalizes possession of the drug, aligning with kind of popular opinion across the country, except in some specific cases, if APD thinks that your specific possession of marijuana charge is connected to a higher level narcotics investigation or a violent felony, they can arrest you for the possession charge. But in most cases, they're supposed to just take the drug and throw it away rather than arrest you or cite you. So it's a pretty big change. The other thing that Prop A did was prohibit the use, APD's use of what are called no-knock search warrants. We talked about these before. Basically, they would allow APD to execute a warrant in a way where they didn't have to announce their presence, right? They could just barge into a suspect's home or property without first, again, announcing themselves. But both of those things are now prohibited per the city charter, thanks to the overwhelming, like you said, landslide election victory.
Both of these were lumped together in a single proposition and were there as a result of a citizen initiative. And that was led by, who was it again?
Ground Game Texas, a relatively new campaign outfit founded by Mike Siegel and Julie Oliver, former Austin area congressional candidates. They both lost twice, but they're kind of refocused their efforts.
And I think Chief Chacon has had a few comments since last Saturday, right?
Yeah, not to me, but he's told other outlets that he intends to comply, I guess, with the prohibition on no-knock search warrants. Austin Police Association President Ken Cassaday, although has said that may not be the case, you know, he kind of said if APD needs to use one of these, they're going to use one. And in fact, the city charter only constrains APD in this way. If some kind of state or federal law enforcement agency is involved with APD and investigation in Austin and they want to use a no-knock search warrant, the city charter can't constrain those higher level law enforcement agencies. So they could certainly seek one out and deploy it that way.
None of this is a surprise. What did it come in? It was more than 80% in favor, wasn't it?
Yeah. 86% are in Travis County and 77% in Williamson County. So even the more conservative suburban part of the city voted to support the measure.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what comes of all this.
I think that about covers it.
We'll keep this brief this week and look forward to talking to you next week, okay?
Sounds good. Thanks.
That's all from us this evening. Stay tuned for Co-op's Local Music Mix next on the HD3 channel and on coop.org. Stay safe, everyone.